Democrats and Republicans continue their back and forth on debt ceiling talks. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, it's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, the 4th of July. Happy Independence Day. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Jeremy Hobson is off today. Well, a look at business and the economy as we start today. We'll talk of a short-term debt solution. Have any effect on the markets? We're going to get some analysis coming up. But first, where's Wall Street? U.S. markets are closed today for the 4th of July holiday. Before closing, though, on Friday, the Dow jumped 168 points to end the day at 12,582. And for the week, the Dow gained a whopping 5%. European and Asian shares were mostly higher today.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
Let's talk about the debt ceiling. There's been one big development over the weekend. The possibility, just a possibility though, of a short-term solution to make sure the country does not default. On Fox News Sunday, Texas GOP Senator John Cornyn said his party will not sacrifice maximum spending cuts just to make a deal.
We're running up against this deadline, and they're going to try to present it as a fait accompli. Nobody's going to have time to read it or consider the implications of it. And he's going to say you have to pass it or the economy is going down the tubes. That's just irresponsible.
Let's get some analysis now from Rob Carnell. He's chief international economist with ING Capital Markets. He's with us live. He's with us from London now. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
We're talking about perhaps a short-term deal to raise the debt ceiling. How would investors take to that?
It really depends whether or not they view any sort of postponement in an agreement as still leaving open the possibility of a credible medium to long-term solution to the U.S. debt and deficit problems.
So the markets are looking for some firm handle on this, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they do need to be given some kind of indication that this isn't just kicking the can down the road forever, that something eventually will be done.
So what kind of signal do they send out very quickly?
I think the easiest thing for them to do is actually raise the debt ceiling by only a small amount so that the window for reaching another deal is very short. That would really focus minds and suggest that they were serious about coming up with a proper deal.
Well, let's see if they are serious indeed. Rob Carnell, Chief International Economist with ING Capital Markets. Thanks.
Thank you.
And now the marketplace global perspective. It is a good news, bad news scenario for Greece. Europe agreed to $17 billion more in bailout money to stop Greece from defaulting in the next couple of weeks. That's good. But Greece could go bust in as little as a couple of months. That's bad. From the Europe desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
Greece needs a second bailout, but there's a problem. The Germans, who would pick up much of the tab, are insisting on a condition. They want the investors who bought Greek government bonds to share some of the pain. So a plan has been developed. After intense negotiations, some bondholders have, voluntarily, agreed to delay cashing in some of their bonds. Seems fine, right? Well, not according to the ratings agency S&P. Julian Pendock of Senhouse Capital says S&P has just ruled that this agreement is not voluntary.
There's been a lot of arm twisting behind the scenes. It is involuntary and therefore counts as what they would call a credit event. Technically, they are saying it counts as a default.
And if Greece defaults, every Greek bank could go bust, and as early as September. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Financial markets in Southeast Asia's second largest economy have welcomed news of a new administration. Thailand is set to have its first female prime minister, Yingluck Shinawatra. Now, Thailand's stock market jumped more than 4% today on that news, and its currency rose as well. That comes after years of political unrest there, which has made foreign investors wary. The BBC's Karishma Vaswani is with us now from Bangkok with the latest. Good morning, Karishma.
Good morning.
Is this new administration business friendly? Was the economy a part of the election success for her?
Yeah, it was really a part of the election success. I mean, in so much as the fact that she kept talking about the fact that she wanted to raise minimum wage. And so that, I think, really went down well with ordinary Thai people who've been feeling, you know, their pockets quite squeezed by the higher food prices. The problem, of course, is that if you have higher salaries, businesses then find it really difficult to operate. So some businesses have already expressed concerns that these higher salaries could mean they won't be able to have as many people on their staff as they used to.
I know Thailand has had a number of coups in the past 80, 90 years. Has that political instability stunted economic development there?
I think so. I think over the last few years, certainly, Thailand has seen a fair amount of political turbulence, and foreign investors have kind of stayed away, although in the last year, you know, they bought back into Thai shares. Today, though, quite surprisingly, we've seen shares jump up some 4-5%. Already you're getting an indication, I think, that with this decisive election victory, people are now starting to believe or having more confidence in Thailand for the future.
What does it mean for U.S. and Thai relations?
Well, you know, Thailand is the U.S.'s oldest Asian ally. I mean, there's a great story about how close these two countries are. In fact, Thailand famously offered to send elephants to Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. So,
wow.
You know, that's a long, long time ago. But in the last few years, because of this political uncertainty, Thailand's been seen by the United States as a country that's going through a really tough time. Now, though, there's a feeling that if Thailand gets its act together with this new leader, if there is political stability, perhaps it can try and regain its reputation as being a bastion of democracy in Southeast Asia.
The BBC's Karishma Vaswani from Bangkok. Karishma, thank you.
No worries.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
There's a brand new requirement this month at Columbia Business School. The school says all faculty must post on the school's website any work they've done outside the university in the last 5 years. It could be a consulting gig or even a speaking engagement. Tracy Samuelson reports now it's a way to keep business credibility for all those professors and teachers.
We tend to think of business and economics professors as academics. But last year, the documentary Inside Job, which set out to explain the financial crisis, said part of our problem is that those academics can also work for hire. Some make big bucks advising the industries and organizations they publish research on or speak to Congress about. Here's filmmaker Charles Ferguson confronting Frederick Mishkin of Columbia Business School about a report he wrote praising the financial stability of Iceland just before its banking system collapsed.
I didn't see any place in the study where you indicated that you had been paid by the Icelandic Chamber of Commerce to produce it.
Mishkin and Columbia declined to speak with me. In a press release, Columbia said its new disclosure rules are due to the financial crisis. But this issue is bigger than just one school. The American Economic Association, the professional body for all U.S. economists, has formed a committee to consider disclosure requirements. It's led by Robert Solo, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and former MIT professor.
It's not enough to say, oh, yes, I am paid a lot of money by such and such an organization, but I don't let that affect my judgment. That may or may not be true, but put it this way, a potential conflict of interest seems to me to be a conflict.
Solo's not sure how the association will manage these conflicts. Columbia is requiring faculty to post on the school's website who they work for and the kind of work they do, but not how much they're paid. Other schools make faculty disclose similar information just to the school. So, are disclosures enough? I put that question to Jay Stowski, a dean at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, which was also mentioned in Inside Job.
I'm certain that there are instances in which the policy in place is that these relationships be disclosed and that there are some people who feel that these relationships should simply be forbidden. And I think that that would come at a great cost.
Stowski says we all benefit when our top scholars work outside the classroom. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Dunkin' Donuts could very well price an initial public offering as early as this week. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins looks beyond the sprinkles of that deal.
Restaurant analyst Peter Soleil says investors are salivating over the Dunkin' Donuts IPO. The company's revenue grew 7% last year, and it has big plans to expand west of the Mississippi. Okay, Soleil's a little biased.
When I travel, I can't get a Dunkin', and it's irritating.
Dunkin' Donuts is one of a couple dozen companies owned by private equity to go public this year. Those companies account for 62% of IPO money raised. In contrast, venture capital-backed companies like LinkedIn and Pandora have gotten lots of attention for their public offerings, but they account for a much smaller share of IPO money raised. Kathy Smith is with Renaissance Capital.
I think it could very well be that in July, not only does America run on Dunkin' Donuts, but the IPO market may run on Dunkin' Donuts.
There's a catch, though. The company is nearly $2 billion in debt.
It's not profitable after the interest on the debt.
Smith says Dunkin' could pay down some of the debt with proceeds from the IPO, but shareholders would still have to stomach the rest. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Maybe you're on the road this long holiday weekend, and even though they've been trending down a little bit lately, gas prices are still a lot higher than they were 1 year ago. That's been bad for the Illinois economy because it's cheaper to get gas in Missouri. From St. Louis Public Radio, Adam Allington reports.
One of the cardinal rules about interstate travel through the Midwest, gas up before you hit Illinois. Illinois levies a hefty 42 cents per gallon tax on gasoline, among the highest gas taxes in the country. Compare that with Missouri, which only charges 17 cents per gallon, and you're bound to see a lot of Illinois license plates in St. Louis gas stations.
We almost never buy gas in Illinois.
Cameron Holloway lives in Illinois and drives across the Mississippi River every day to work in St. Louis. During the last oil crisis in 2008, he actually ran out of gas trying to make it to Missouri.
I always know that in Illinois it's 20 cents or so more than it is in Missouri, and so I'm always going to fill up over here.
And it's not just gasoline where Missouri undercuts its neighbor. The state also has lower taxes on beer, liquor, cigarettes, even sales tax.
This is a fall-on-the-sword issue when it comes to state fuel taxes, state tobacco taxes.
Ron Leone heads a lobbying group for Missouri's gas stations and convenience stores. He says the lower taxes attract tens of thousands of cross-border shoppers every day.
We will do everything within our power to keep them low, to keep them reasonable.
But critics point out that cutting taxes on gas or cigarettes has never actually increased state revenues or paid for any new roads or bridges. Ralph Martiri is the director of an Illinois think tank called the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability.
All the data show that supply-side theory of public finance, it just doesn't work. So anyone who's counting on that coming through, people buying substantially more gasoline because the taxes are lower, are, I think the technical fiscal term is goofy.
Martiri says a race to the bottom in taxes may not be a successful long-term strategy. He points to studies in Illinois that show every tax dollar spent on infrastructure has actually created $1.50 in economic activity. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
And finally, an Oregon man says he spent $1 million developing a razor built for the ages. The Zafiro has sapphire blades that'll last 10 years or more, and a non-corrosive body made from iridium, which is something found in meteors that'll withstand a lifetime of rigorous up-and-down motion. But before you bust out to the store to buy this special little guy, the price? $100,000. He hasn't sold not one of them yet. Forget razor burn. That's sticker shock. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Enjoy your 4th of July holiday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.